So we've kind of got to sort of seeing ourselves, people and things existing like illusions kind of helps to reduce negative, unfavourable emotions because they stem from our exaggeration, kind of superimposing qualities, good or bad, on things beyond that which they actually have. And the benefit of liberating insight is that it prevents us from attributing either a goodness or a badness to an object's way beyond what's actually there. And the undermining of the self-deception makes it possible to reduce and diminish the power of attachment and aversion, desire and hatred, because those emotions are actually built onto or given rise to by the exaggeration. And either the reduction or the elimination of unhealthy emotions creates a space in which healthier emotions and virtues can either develop or manifest, depending on your developmental or discovery model. You know, in the one, the space is there to cultivate and develop and bring other more positive emotions and healthy emotions to the fore, or the mere clearing away of the space being crowded out by the negative emotions built on the exaggeration just allows the natural qualities to spontaneously pour forth. And there's a quote from His Holiness there: by viewing them with insight, you bring them within the scope of the practice of emptiness. And then in his sequence of things, His Holiness is talking about then the cultivation of love, compassion, and the generation of bodhicitta and those sorts of practices. But also says when you do those practices, you should remember that the same thing applies, that the love, the compassion, you, the person that you're generating or cultivating in respect of, are still appearing like a magician's illusions without any inherent existence, although of course they exist. And before we go on, because we're moving on to another topic, so is there any more there on what we've covered so far? Any questions or clear about where we are and so on? No, yeah, this also applies to the emotions, thoughts and feelings that arise when you are on the wrong end of behaviours. Yeah? So it's still that those behaviours arise independent upon their causes and conditions. I think it's a little like we were speaking earlier, it's where we're kind of familiar with this one. It's one thing to say, if Roy was horrible to you, you say you're a really unkind person, rather than saying that was unkind. Unkind addresses the behaviour. You're an unkind person says something about the person. Yeah, it might be rooted in that people can be either inherently this way or that way or whatever. Whereas the behaviour, you know, it's the same with teaching. It's one thing to say that a behaviour is silly or stupid or unskillful, or you know, however politely or strongly you put it, but it's not a good idea to actually sort of stick the label on the child or the person if you're teaching adults, so that do you see the difference?
So the behaviour may still be blatantly wrong or unkind, yeah, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's again something to just
the conventions of the world are unaffected by this. Yeah. So it doesn't somehow make that which is wrong or that which is unkind or whatever somehow not so. Yeah, it's just recognizing that out of put it in the you know, one person to another situation, that the person under the illusion that they're inherently existing in a way that they don't, and that what's happened to them or the causes and conditions that have arisen to provoke the behaviour, lying or whatever else, doesn't really have any inherent existence. It's something that's arising out of ignorance. Person kind of sleepwalking at that level, not awake, you know, in that sense. And then the thing itself doesn't have any inherent existence. It doesn't exist from its own side. And then there's how we react to it or respond to it, yeah. And there's our own falling under the spell of thinking that we inherently exist from our own side, not that these emotions don't come up as a result of causes and conditions, but somehow exist from their own side. Insight into all that should make more skillful response possible. In that space, you can be more skillful, and you know, it's perfectly possible to point out or demonstrate that something was not right without all the rest. Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of vehemence and force behind it.
Mm.
And it's becoming confrontational and getting aggressive, and a lot of emotion is piling in around it. Then it's, chances are it's probably over exaggerated, no, in terms of the way we're going. But no, it doesn't. How can I say, the conventional aspects kind of remain the same. Are you familiar with the two truths? Are we clear about that? Because that can be helpful if there's not a clarity about that. No.
Which two?
I'll try.
The two of the three, the two of the four, the two of the eight.
Ah.
There's so many different
And also this, I have to admit that this one is problematic, because of course, in the English language, the truth itself really only points at one. So to talk about two truths is a bit odd, and it is a bit odd, but it's just a linguistic oddness. I think if I explain it, you'll see what I mean, or whether you want to use other words for it. But it's saying the reality of anything at all, and it relates to what we're talking about here in terms of ourselves, the reality of anything at all is kind of both. There's a relative aspect and an ultimate aspect. Yeah. So the relative, what's called the relative truth, really covers all kind of dualistic phenomena, ourselves, other beings, material objects, thoughts, emotions, concepts that make up conventional life in the world, you know, anything and everything. And in the Indian sense, in the Indian non-Buddhist sense, that's what the Hindus would be referring to, or many Hindus would be referring to, as Maya, or illusion. Yeah. Because we mistakenly believe they're solid, separate, and independent realities, when they're in actual fact not. But the problem is not relative truth itself, but our misunderstanding of its nature. But that's only revealed when we understand ultimate truth. Yeah. So ultimate truth is the reality beyond dualism of any kind. It's also the true nature of relative phenomena. And then from a Mahayana Buddhist perspective, That's called emptiness, yeah, or interdependence. Emptiness and interdependence are one and the same thing. We'll see a bit more of that in a moment, i.e. because things are interdependent, there's no possibility of inherent existence. It's not kind of the other way around. And I think Thich Nhat Hanh talks about it in terms of interbeing. No? That's what he means by interbeing. And in Vajrayana Buddhism, absolute reality is also referred to as space, complete openness, or primordial purity. So you've got that relative and ultimate truth. So the doctrine of the two truths is what's called a provisional teaching in Buddhism, i.e. it's helpful for where we are on the path, but not a final truth. So this doctrine itself is seen as being relative to the path. And the final truth is there's only, you know, ineffable reality, at least not two, that we can point at, and that it unites the relative and the ultimate. So ultimate truth is the true nature of the relative. Relative truth is a manifestation or appearance of the ultimate. And they're indivisible, inseparable, kind of right here, right now, as two conceptual isolates of our experience. So in respect of behaviours, you know, which are clearly provable and verifiably wrong from a conventional point of view, these are not in any way negated, yeah? And would not in any way be negated from a karmic perspective either. They are causes which have effects. It's solely about how we experience them and how we see them. Yeah, and if we, enmeshed in our own, or enmeshed in kind of under the influence of our own misconception of our inherent existence existing from our own side, encounter the behaviour which we see in the same way as existing from its own side and inherently existing from another as we see it inherently existing person, then that's where the fight starts, no? That's where the problem is. But if we have at least some insight into the fact that it's not quite the way it appears, then there's a possibility for more space and dealing with it in a more skillful way. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I think the thing to keep remembering, which is hard, in the denial or negation of inherent existence, it doesn't mean it exists. It doesn't exist.
Yeah, I think, and I'm just trying this to all, it's feel a, my way around that.
Yeah, it is difficult. We say it. We think, oh yeah, I get it. It's not about whether it exists or not. It's how it exists. But and it seems to go in easily. But then we think,
then the two get confused. And where doesn't it apply? Like,
yeah, it applies in terms of trying to see how things actually are, which is ultimate truth,
yeah.
It applies absolutely universally everywhere. Yeah?
Mm.
But it doesn't alter or mean that the conventional existence is irrelevant or doesn't exist.
Yeah,
it does exist, yeah. It just doesn't exist in the way we think it does. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that should provide the space for more skillful action, more positive ways of dealing with things, and so on and so forth. Yeah, but it doesn't somehow provide a pair of rose-tinted glasses where everything's all right then, and anything goes. No, I mean, clearly, if someone steals, they steal. If someone lies, they lie. If someone murders, they murder. If someone falsely accuses us, they falsely accuse us. You know, that's how it is. But how we perceive that, how we respond to it, how we see it, would make a huge difference to how much suffering we and others have as a result. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
I think it could. If you behave differently, different things will happen.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
And I've certainly found that, you know, in mm-hmm. rare moments where I have had my wits about me in this sense, mm-hmm. And don't react as people might expect me to react, mm-hmm. I get a different response.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yes, that's a good point, that one. That mm-hmm. that if we are able to have insight mm-hmm. and respond rather than react, then very often yeah. the result will of course be different. But and also it's like we have to kind of, I think the most important one there is that we have to be present and aware of all of this.
We're not.
So inevitably there yeah, yeah. will be moments
no,
where
not. That's,
you're
yeah.
like,
damn, yeah. damn, that's why.
That's, I mean, that's why, you know, is yeah. is that's why in the tradition it said, you know, unless you're exceptionally lucky and have a complete realization of emptiness mm. while you're listening to this, then it's going to be a matter of practice. Mm. Yeah, mm. it's going to be a matter of saying, well, how do I create the causes and conditions for me to have this insight, recollect and recognize it more often?
Well,
and that sort of practice does that. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's even the business, isn't it? Just trying to be present. Because if we're not present, then we're wrapped up in something else. Mm. And then whatever happens right there and then is a shock or up. And then it's like this. But if we were actually present, if we were actually there, then the possibility for seeing things as they actually are mm. is increased. But presence itself is something we have to yeah. practice or cultivate. Because most of us... Although there is the possibility here, of course, being present won't stop it. Yeah. But there's a sense in which if I'm present to anger arising in me, mm-hmm. it's very different than just being carried away by the anger. So again, the conventional reality may not seem a bit like the Muller-Lyer illusion. You still see it, one is longer than the other, but you kind of know that that's not true, that's not how it exists. So when the anger arises, it's real in its own way, at a conventional and illusion-like level. But I kind of know that it doesn't have the power, it doesn't exist in the way it appears to exist. I can be present to it and it can come up, still be there and go. Yeah, so it's not an all or nothing thing. Is that helpful? So you can, there's still the possibility of being present even when all this stuff is going on. But if you are, then there's different things are possible. Different outcomes might come as a result. It's like it's an old Greek one. You can find it in Buddhism and in other wisdom traditions too, that the level of a person's being, kind of, which is to do with where they are, attracts their life. Mm. Yeah? Mm. And if we all know, I mean, I had one a couple of weeks before I came away where a person was quite depressed. I mean, obviously not we're talking clinical depression here, but was, you know, they were in a very low moment. And they'd been applying for jobs. And while I was talking to them, they pushed the thing away and said, oh, I can't even be bothered to do that, you know, sort of like that. And I said, you're looking for jobs, don't miss out on that one, kind of thing. And they said, oh yeah, but this. I said, well, if it's just do it, you know, better done than not done. It's an opportunity missed otherwise. And not because there's any magic about me, but the person got the job. Not only did they get the interview, they got the job. And they were about to throw it because they felt depressed about something else. They would have lost that opportunity altogether. Do you see what I mean? So the level of a person's awareness, presence, being can make a lot of difference. Yeah, and it could have been, oh, you know, I'm very blue today, you know, or I'm pissed off about this or I'm pissed off about that. But that shouldn't affect what I've got to do to get this job. But if you're completely weighed down by it, and it's all, it's no longer even a, it's not even a real possibility. You've convinced yourself, you know, that you are like this, the world is like that, and you don't see the opportunities that might actually be there. Yeah. Or in another case, you may see things that aren't there, but yeah. But I agree, no, it's, that's, I think that's why sometimes people have a heavy heart, don't they? They say, oh, the Tibetan problem with, you know, Indo-Tibetan practices is you have to keep doing them and doing them and doing them, and endlessly repeating them and coming back to the practice. And how do we keep our practices more alive, you know, to not have it all go flat? It's just kind of, I think what sometimes we miss, that I always I find exceptional in people following Indian and also Tibetans in particular, is the length of their view. When they mean long term, they mean long term. You know what I mean? And it's like we can't really, or I find myself sometimes, I think it's really difficult for me to connect with that. I mean, they will almost, you know, well, they'll almost at a point say, you say, well, I might never achieve that in a lifetime. Only one lifetime, you know. Yeah. Bloody hell.
Yeah.
You know, think yourself lucky. You know, it's that, there's that kind of really, really long-term vision. So if you say to somebody, well, you know, if you want to get into this, want to do this practice, it might take a few years. They're like, oh, wow, that's hardly any time at all. That's really feasible. That's doable. You know what I mean? Whereas we tend to think, oh, if I can't make it by Christmas, I'll do something else. So it is. It's like repeated practice, repeated and coming at it from different angles and doing what we're doing, you know, to try and get the insight, keep the insights, repeat the insights, and then see what happens. Anyway, it's 4 o'clock. Gone extra. So we'll do 20 minutes.
Okay.
Is you happy with that?
Yep.
20 minutes from the time we get out there.
Okay.
I think I can accommodate that. It's my fault. Yeah. So we'll come back. So 4:20, 4:25.